lot of, it's like a lot of things in my life. It's sort of like a super obvious thing that I don't pay close enough attention to. And consequently, because I don't pay close enough attention to it, I don't end up with a practice. And I'm very committed to practice in the spiritual life. Although I also find practice in the spiritual life to be like going to the gym. Does anyone go to the gym successfully? How do you go to the gym successfully? Okay, so there's a net of relationship plus, what's the first thing you said? I'm sorry. Habit. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I don't go to the gym.
Okay, well then don't talk.
Well.
No, 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 wait. No, you get next.
Pilates.
Okay, well Pilates I'll count, even though it's devil exercise like yoga.
Anytime it's the devil exercise. No, Pilates.
You open up your chakras and the devil gets right in. No, go ahead. I was teasing you.
Well, I mean, anytime I've been able to do any form of exercise successfully over a period of time, like Pilates, like yoga, like Tai Chi, other things, it's because I find a certain amount of pleasure in it. And I miss it when I don't do it.
Right. Yeah. How do you get yourself doing this gym thing? So you have named the variable which does not work in a long-term sense for anything that people do, which is guilt. Guilt is actually only one of a stinky bouquet of phenomena, which actually is more powerfully inspired in me, the stinky bouquet, by the phenomenon of shame. So I feel ashamed when I don't do what I think I'm supposed to, right? So to go back to my experience of prayer and going to the gym, because I thought it was something I had to do, like taking a spoonful of medicine that was bitter, I didn't like to do it, right? And you mentioned pleasure. And Lisi, who's no longer there, mentioned inspiration. And you mentioned that sense of, I will say, power or something. And in the life of prayer, my experience has been for in certain eras of my life that prayer was a duty more than a pleasure. And so then the obvious thing, which I've actually known my whole life, is that my life in prayer is actually a life of making stuff. My life in prayer is a life of making stuff. So here's what I wrote in my journal on the 20th of May. What is interesting is the feeling I get in the morning when I anticipate a day of painting. I feel exhilarated. It is joy. When I recognize that this is my prayer, and in prayer there is joy, I begin to understand more of what my life course needs to be. Making is the way that I know God's presence in my life. I think that I've known this my whole life. I think about the following that brought me joy: drawing in church, doodling in my school notebooks. The summer I was 11, just made shit all the time. The craft building at the YMCA of the Rockies, the art house at my granny's house, the shop in mom's backyard, going there every day after school, making doll houses for my sisters, listening to music and drawing. Art classes my freshman year, learning how to draw, learning how to use pastel, art class when I dropped out of college, making shit in college and after, just whatever, liturgical installation art, vestments, all the shit I did at my home church. I said shit a lot in my journal. Painting the Julian of Norwich thing that I did at the Seminary of the Southwest, and icons. So I continue to read. When I think of the projects that were frustrating or that made me suffer, they are about a lack of time or a lack of energy or a lack of knowing what I was doing. I could see the end result, but I didn't know how to get there. Let me say that again. I could see the end result, but I didn't know how to get there. Examples are, the example I wrote in my journal, I preached about this before, that the summer I tried to build a harpsichord. Because I could see the finished product. You've got a harpsichord. You've got several harpsichords.
You still got all your fingers.
I still do. Because I couldn't finish it. Because I didn't have the time or the energy or the skill. Okay, are you picking up something about practice? Because practice is what I want to spend a lot of time and energy on in the third half of my life. Then I wrote, the joy was there in these failed projects, at least in the beginning, but I didn't know how to kindle the joy into something more. As this is prayer to me that is making, I guess that I didn't rely on the energy of God. I didn't confess myself to the task. I didn't do the work in a context of the Holy Trinity. It was just me being energized by my ego. And that didn't work. And it still doesn't. I didn't confess myself to the task. And then I said, this is fucking awesome. Just wanted to check the room real fast to make sure it was PG-13 friendly. I'm back from sabbatical. I'll clam up. Don't worry. So all of that is a prelude to talking about the work that I did at this place on the screen, which is a picture of the Community of the Resurrection in Murfield. The Community of the Resurrection, as I said last week, is an Anglican monastic community started in the late 19th century. Really cool place. This is a picture of the large lawn in front of the main house of the monastery and the church in the background with the dome-looking thing at the end. Rick, does that look familiar to you, being an alum? Good. So this was the place that I did my work. And this is what I started with. So we have icon painters over here. We got an icon painter here. We got others. We got one there. We got them scattered around like glitter. You know the thing about scattering glitter. You can't ever clean it up. So when you start doing an icon, you start with a pure kind of white board. You hope it's pure. And it represents, because everything in icon painting represents something. Because the Orthodox. Everything represents something to the Orthodox. What does the pure field of the icon board represent?
The uncreated light of God.
Which sounds really cool, right? Because uncreated light is a great thing, and we're singing the song about it today. Uncreated light is a great thing. But what is the uncreated light of God for?
Creation.
Yeah, it's the goal of spiritual practice.
Emptiness.
Yep.
Is what really is.
That is a good Buddhist response, and I appreciate it deeply.
Yeah, from a very different perspective.
And so the Orthodox actually say the same thing. in terms of icon painting. It's just that the Orthodox, who never met a surface they didn't want to embellish, right, say that the uncreated light of God is what makes everything visible. And in fact, is the uncreated light of God represented in the white board of the icon that makes the color of the icon possible. Which is why in the technique of icon painting, you start with dark colors and end with light colors. So you know at the beginning where the shadow is. And the hardest part of painting an icon, in my experience, is this, which is actually messing the board up. Because the icon is also more than just paint, it's also gold, you got to do this stuff with clay. And you have to lay the clay down. If you've done the icon class before, you know that this is another scary moment, because the clay is a temperamental substance. It does not necessarily like to be under your control. And what does the clay represent in iconology? Earth, us. Yeah. So in the icon class that we do, it's called the Adam, the Adam. It's the beginning stuff. It's the stuff that we're made out of. It's clay and it's soft. You put several layers on if you do it the way I do, but then you have to grind it down with very fine sandpaper and you have to polish it until it's like a mirror because, and here's the tricky thing, the shininess of the icon gold, here, the reflective quality of it does not come from the gold. It comes from the glassy surface of the clay. Because the gold is so thin. It's like thinner than tissue. Molecules thick. So that whatever is underneath it shows. And you might notice that since the clay is Adam, it's us, and the gold on top of it is another aspect of the light of God, what it means is that we show through where God is present. So in the kind of prayer life of icons, which, you know, for me is prayer, in the making of it, and it takes forever to do this, and your back hurts and your shoulder hurts and your neck hurts and your hands hurt and everything hurts, in the making of this, you have ample opportunity to reflect on what it means to make the light of God shine in your own experience, in your own life. I'm getting a little ahead of myself in this, because the fact of the matter is the only thing that really screws up making an icon is complaining about it. Which is the first thing you want to do. So it's really hard to do. But that makes your body tense. It makes your mind tense. It makes your hands tense. And everything kind of goes crazy. And so you have to take a break and you have to go out and have some non-caffeinated beverage. And you have to calm down and you have to breathe and you have to breathe and you have to breathe. And then all of a sudden it's 5 hours later. So I have also put in some rather beautiful views of Yorkshire. This is a view from the grounds of the monastery, looking out towards the south, I guess. And it's just gorgeous, the whole place. I mean, every kind of view is beautiful. See at the travelogue. That's my journal, in which I wrote every day I was up there, more or less, except for the days that I didn't. And that is the view from the room where I would do my journal writing, which shows you a little bit more of what the space looks like that I was occupying on the first part of my sabbatical. Down here is the refectory. It's where we eat our meals. Up here are where the brothers live. And it's an old manor house that's been added on to over the years, right? So it's got, you know, a lot of stairways and things. So I mentioned that the first layer of paint you put on is the darkest, and it's the most chaotic. And it's also absolutely necessary, because the chaotic quality of color and the texture of paint has to show through. So if the white is the uncreated light of God and the clay is us and the gold is also more God and we're shining through that, the chaotic is also us and the chaos of our own souls, chaos of our own experience, which is absolutely essential to who we are. Have you ever met a person who was too calm, that didn't have anything stirring beneath the surface? I mean, I've met a couple. Some of them are really nice. Some of them are really psychotic. You know, they will walk up to you with a smile on their face and just give you the shiv and the kidney. So it's actually owning this chaotic part of yourself. And I would say that, you know, I would say some pious moralistic thing about that, like God works with whatever, which is true, but I can't take a pejorative stance toward the shadow, because the shadow is essential. The chaos and the darkness and the roughness of your inner life in prayer is essential, because it gives a kind of texture to what comes next. And the denial of it, the denial of the shadow, only makes you sick. Yes, Stephen?
Chaos is a gift.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. It is. The whole thing is a gift.
I've also heard it explained as primordial.
Thank you, yes. Primordial. It is the stuff that is in the context of the Hebrew Bible, it's the stuff that God makes out of the chaos, the primordial, dark, scratchy stuff. So the task is to actually work with what it is you got. That's beginning to work with it. As I said a moment ago, that in icons, you start with dark colors and you move to light colors, always. You say always in anything and you know there's an exception. But the idea is to build up layers of lighter and lighter and finer paint so that that primordial, chaotic, rough, shadowy stuff begins to take form in a more familiar way. How many of you finished reading Natalie Carne's book, St. Gregory of Nyssa and Beauty, besides me? I know, it was a hard read. It was a hard read for me. It really sucked. But there's a section in her book, and I can't even remember what it is, there's a section in her book where she talks about suffering and beauty. Right? Suffering and beauty. And the aperture through which she looks at this issue is to think of a crucifix, which is how can something that is so brutal be beautiful. And what does she say about that? Because there's a kind of love that does not draw back from suffering. There's a kind of love which looks at suffering as something that is not finally destructive, but looks at suffering as something which can be loved and can be redeemed by love. Which, by the way, does not mean you should go out and seek suffering. Because you really don't have to. As it turns out, suffering is a part of life. And the denial of that suffering makes your life less real. So I had an awful experience during my sabbatical, where someone came to visit me, and came from Europe, and was detained for 2 hours at border control. And this person has an anxiety disorder. And this person went into a full-blown panic attack that I had to sit with for 3 days. And it was very hard. And it reminded me of the very hard part of my father's dying, which is still relatively fresh. And the fact that the brutality of suffering is a great invitation to turn away. Because everything else in my life says to turn away from suffering. Everything says turn away from your mortality, do not pay attention to the suffering in the world, do not worry too much about anything, Amazon.com. And the fact of the matter is, when I turn away from suffering, I am unable to do this work, which is to create form out of primordial chaos. And in really good icons, you can always see the primordial chaos beneath the form. You can always see the roughness. The roughness never disappears, just like the suffering in life never disappears. And then you do more of it, and you get more refinement of the forms. And then we have another lovely interlude. So I also had access to the monastic library. Ooh, like something out of something. And because I had access to the monastic library, I could like find all sorts of things. So this is a third edition of Hymns of the Eastern Church, translated with notes and an introduction by the Reverend J.M. Neal, D.D. So that's John Mason Neal's hymn book of Eastern hymns. So who was John Mason Neal? He wrote a bunch of hymns. Name a hymn that John Mason Neal wrote. Come on. No. But that was a good guess. Come on. Because I don't know one. I thought somebody would know one. A lot of the hymns that we sing here, John Mason Neal wrote, and he's on the wall around the corner. Okay. If somebody thinks of one before the end of the conversation, let it be known. So then, when I found myself in this situation of bringing form up out of chaotic space, when I found myself in this situation of looking at, as it ended up being, this icon for a super long time, I noticed that I started looking at everything. So that's some stone pavers outside with stuff growing in them. And I was like, I wanted to remember what some of the details looked like because I didn't want to remember the detail necessarily, but I wanted to remember the fact of the matter is when you begin to look intently at something, you begin to see everything. This is another practice. The practice of looking. Because if you've ever taken an art class or if you've ever studied art, you know that the first hurdle to get over is your prejudice about what the object is you're trying to represent. Because I know what a flower looks like. Da, 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 da. I know what a tree looks like. It's a green ball on a brown stick, right?
Seeing is forgetting the name of the thing one sees.
So,
seeing is forgetting the name of the thing one sees.
Right. Seeing is forgetting the name of the thing one sees. Libby. All glory, laud, and honor. Thank you very much. You're the winner. You get a free prize. Yes. Yes.
But I can teach you how to see.
Yes. So and artists are only as special as any other human being is special. And everybody has the opportunity to see. As a practice, seeing and paying attention and attending to has the power, I believe, to break you from your prejudgments. Which ties back into suffering, by the way. Because you can't forget the suffering that you see. Like you can't forget the beauty that you see if you want to see more. So I live across the street from the Full House House, which is a TV show you may have heard of. We get 1,000 tourists a day during the summer. And they all want to take a picture of themselves in front of it because Instagram. And you have read stories about Instagram is ruining things, and like there's the peony garden that was open to the public, but people would ignore the signs and step over the ropes and crush the peonies and take selfies. That is not seeing. That is a consumeristic view of what is. And I post to Instagram too. But seeing is not a commodity. Seeing is a practice that opens you up to see more. Okay, so that's my little stone on the ground photo. And then, that's my work table. Little reading glasses, little things of pigment, little icon, little lamp. Cost a bundle to get all that over there. And then, speaking of seeing, the longer I was doing this work, I could see little vignettes around the monastery. This is a picture in the monastery church, and you can see back here is the altar in what's called the Resurrection Chapel, which is really weird, and it's limestone, I think, and it's got carvings on four sides, and on the back of it, it's got a little cave opening. It's like a tomb, right? It's fabulous. And this is a very beautiful statue of Our Lady on a plinth. And the light, obviously, makes it especially beautiful. So the more I got into painting the icon, the more I got into conversation with who the figures are in the icon, it's a set group. This is not the finished icon. So in the middle is Jesus. On this side is Adam, on this side is Eve. Jesus is standing on the gates of hell, which he's just burst open. I'll talk more about that in a second. Traditionally, there are royal persons depicted, Solomon and David. This is John the Baptist. This is Moses. This is Abel. And this one I threw in for fun, that's Hagar. Not Hagar. That's, what's her face? I said Hagar on my blog once, and Donald. Rahab, thank you. I always get Rahab and Hagar confused. Too many vowels. That's Rahab, because I thought there needs to be a prostitute in the icon, who's also a relative of Jesus. Oh, and I took this picture just to show you the names of the brothers. This is their check-in, check-out board. Super fun. Once you start getting towards the end of painting the icon, you have to make critical decisions about how much light it's going to have, how much highlight it's going to have. Because it can have a lot of highlight or it can have a little highlight. It can be super dramatic or it can be super subtle. And depending on the size of the icon, sometimes it has to be pretty subdued. So, again, when I think about this in relationship to the life of prayer, the decisions that we make about how much detail to put in strikes me as another way of thinking about, analyzing, interrogating what our life of prayer is. How much do we need to pray for people? Somebody says, pray for me. I'm like, okay, I will. What are the details? How many details do I need to have? I thought God knew what we needed to pray for before we asked. Why do I have to have all the details? And one of the distinctions, it is a distinction in the Orthodox liturgy, is that you don't get a lot of details about who you're praying for. You get a fast list of names for Peggy and Ann and da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da, because God already knows. But in terms of my life in prayer, because God knows what we need before we ask, how granular do I need to be? I mean, because when I ask that question, it raises the question of how do you spend a day in prayer if you're going super granular? Is not every action that we take in the course of the day prayer? If we're seeing, truly as God longs for us to see, if we're actually seeing more because we're disciplining ourselves and practicing seeing, how much detail do we need? And I don't really have an answer to that. That just kind of occurred to me. So that's a freebie without a lot of comment. Mark?
It seems to me that compassion is somewhere in there.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm reminded of what you said about sitting with your visitors for a few days while they recovered from their trauma.
Yeah. Yeah, it's true. Because, you know, in terms of our pastoral care, you can't do everything for another, nor should you. I always think the first time I started out training to be a marriage, family, child counselor. My first intern supervisor had a little consulting room with a little coffee table, and she had two things on her coffee table. One was a container of Power Putty. And the other was a book, the title of which was The Power is in the Patient. And I said, what's that book about? She's like, I have no idea. I just like the title, and I leave it there so people can see it to get a sense that the power that they need is actually already in them, right? So to me, the analogy is I can't do everything for another person, nor should I. And if I do too many details in an icon, it turns into crazy. Okay, falling over. Here's the front door of the guest house. Beautiful, roses everywhere. So we finally get, we're almost finished. We finally get another beautiful view. Hello, Yorkshire, my old friend. Lovely, okay. We finally get, to this part. So the very end of the icon, when everything is formed up nicely, when the light is right, when everything is working the way it needs to work, then you get into the final details of the icon. Things like inscriptions, little tiny brush marks called ojevki. What are ojevki? The final highlights. Spiritual light. Yeah. Very fine. Yeah. So it kind of comes back around to that sense of uncreated light. Yeah. So it gives life to it. So you do that. And then you do these crazy little details. So this icon, by the way, of the resurrection, according to my study of it, is supposed to represent fast upward motion. Like Jesus is like yanking these folks out of the grave, which, and you can see it better maybe on the icon itself, which is why he's not grabbing their hands. He's actually grabbing their wrists. And these two are like, huh, what? I thought it was dead. And this sense of upward motion, the sense of the eternal light around Christ, standing on the gates of hell. My favorite part of this icon, which I did like in an afternoon of intense something, are all the broken locks and chains on the floor. And they're like tiny. And I was just like, you know, in a place doing this. It was crazy. Which brings to mind, in the course of the icon, how much we get locked up in our spiritual practice because we think we're not doing it right, or we're guilted out for it, so we're not doing it because who likes guilt, or we decide we're going to do a 72-day Ignatian retreat and we actually don't have the capacity for it, or I don't even know what. Or I think I'm supposed to pray this way, I can't, so I can't pray, or God, Shmod, whatever, or it's all sort of benign therapeutic self-help, or whatever it is. The fascinating thing to me, and the icon of the resurrection says it so clearly, is that those locks and chains are broken. unless we put them back on. Yeah. So, you know, we have the capacity to bind ourselves up in all sorts of stuff. And so for me, in terms of my life of prayer, the invitation is to release, because there's nothing to lock you up. It's just a way of being in your life. It's just a practice. It's like breathing. Okay, I think I got one last. Oh, yeah, two last. So there's a cemetery on the monastery grounds. This is the lych gate to the cemetery. And I put this up on the blog. But this is the grave of Brother Benedict Green, who was an inspiration to a young man named Richard Fabian, who started this church. And what's fascinating to me about the graveyard, and there's, I don't know, 50-ish graves. They have the name of the person. You can't see it because it's up under here. They have the birth date of the person. They have the date of the person's monastic vocation, final monastic vocation, and they have their death day. Yeah. So it's like... Yeah. So you have this, like, collection of dead people because they come to the community for their whole life. And they're born in natural life, and then they're born in monastic life. And then they are born into eternal life. And that idea of stability in the monastic life is one of the things which I find beautiful, frightening, and desirable. That's the finished icon, but you can see it up close here. And that's me looking happy. So, I can't bear to look at that too much. So, that's me doing the icon, which we will bless today, and then it'll stay here. But what comments do you have?
It's smaller than I thought it was going to be.
It's smaller than I thought it was going to be, too. These eyes and these little... tiny hands. John?
Your most recent comment there about trying to stay focused and breaking the chain reminds me of my participation in classic bikes, where people obsess over making sure the right colors.
Oh, I know. I know.
And decals are the right generation.
Yeah.
And you have to have the right gate code on the lock nuts.
I know. Yeah.
And that has become, as it were, an iconic phrase on our worldwide discussion list, because it helps everybody get back to basics, get on the bike and ride it.
Yeah, I mean, it's the old saying that the perfect is the enemy of the good. Mm-hmm. Judith. Oh, yeah. The last step is putting the finish on, which in this case is linseed oil. Which is an anointing, and you sort of rub it in, and it soaks in, and you wipe it off, and linseed oil doesn't dry; it catalyzes, so it dries slowly, and it soaks through all of the layers, and it makes a single layer, so it's a very durable, theoretically a very durable surface. You can take a razor blade to this and mess it up, but it's a pretty durable surface. That's why you can kiss icons a lot without leaving too many lipstick stains. But do wipe off your lipstick first. Betsy?
Surprised by the choice of white for candles
closed. It was traditional, so I just decided to go for it. I also thought it was a nice tie-in between the old Adam and the new Adam. And then she is dressed in the color of Mary, Theotokos. So it's like the mother and the mother. And then I put a couple of angels up in here holding a cross, just for kicks. Yeah?
I don't have near the experience of what you do. When I work on mine, especially
Yeah.
It reminds me of the potter and clay story
yep.
from the Bible.
Yep.
From both points of view, from God's mm-hmm. and being, I don't know how you can help but be frustrated when mm-hmm. he's trying to get us in the right shape.
Yeah.
And then also from our point of view, it ain't going to go that way.
No. Yeah. Has anybody ever thrown a pot on a wheel? That was like the super easiest thing to ever do, right? No. It's insanely difficult. I mean, it looks easy, but it's just not. Because it can go a thousand ways crazy. Yeah. Yeah. Judith? Yeah. Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah, and same thing with the paints. I mean, sometimes the paints are like the good consistency and all the rough stuff that you want is down at the bottom or at the top or whatever. It is a skill-based thing and also an intuitive thing. So we've got... That's right. Oops. All built on humans. So it is 10:30. We have made it through. Next week is First Sunday. If you don't mind bringing food, I will eat it.